All rise. Oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Robert N. Davis presiding. All have business before this court. Draw near, and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning. I am Chief Judge Davis. To my right is Judge Peach. To my left is Judge Meredith. We are here today in the matter of Matthew W. Krumlich against Wilkie, docket number 17-2630, to consider the issue, among others, whether the court should affirm the July 13, 2017 decision of the board, which found that the appellant had not submitted a timely substantive appeal to an August 8, 2013 rating decision denying him entitlement to service connection for post-traumatic stress disorder and residuals of low back injury. Would counsel for both parties please note your appearance for the record?
Meet Derek Franklin on behalf of Matthew Krumlich, the veteran from the Office of Sean Kendall, Your Honor.
Ms. Franklin?
Brandon Callahan on behalf of the Secretary, Your Honor. With me at counsel's table is James Cowden, Deputy Chief Counsel.
All right. Welcome, gentlemen. Thank you. Are both parties ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Each party will have 30 minutes to present your respective arguments. Counsel for the appellant, do you wish to reserve a portion of your time for rebuttal?
I wish to reserve 10 minutes, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, Don. Mr. Franklin, you may proceed.
Chief Judge Davis, Judge Peach, and Judge Meredith, may it please the court. The Secretary violated the guarantee of procedural fairness provided by the Due Process Clause when it mailed the veteran a statement of the case that included an undated cover letter instructing the veteran to file his appeal within 60 days of the mailing of the cover letter. The due process rights were violated because this court has long recognized that veterans do have a due process right in seeking benefits. And
Mr.
it's even
Mr.
more...
Franklin, let me cut to the chase on this. For me, the critical issue is whether or not the SOC notice contained in the SOC is sufficient for notice purposes. I understand there's no dispute regarding the lack of a date on the letter. I saw nothing in the record regarding an envelope mailed or stamped or otherwise. I don't know if the envelope wasn't available or what. But the bottom line is the statement of the case notice sufficient to cure any missing date on the letter?
And Chief Judge Davis, it is not. Would you like me to answer the other questions about the envelope?
Sure.
It's not in the record, but I have had this veteran since he came into the office. He did not have the envelope.
Okay.
So I can't speak to it.
That answers a question I had.
Okay.
So thank you.
You're welcome. In answering your question, can the restatement to the regulation within the statement of the case cure the defect of the cover letter, it absolutely cannot, okay? And the reasons for that are that, first off, the regulation 20.302 is in conflict with the enabling statute 7105D3, and the court gives no deference to the agency's interpretation of that statute because in Percy you were very clear that that statute is unambiguous. Okay, that statute allows a veteran 60 days from mailing the statement of the case for a veteran to submit a substantive appeal. The regulation conflicts with that because it uses the date of the statement of the case, not the cover letter, which is the vessel in which the statement of the case is mailed, right, as the date to decide if a substantive appeal was mailed. Also, if you look to the statement of the case and the cover letter that was sent with it, the first paragraph of the statement of the case tells the veteran, you filed a notice of disagreement. This is our first step in appealing to the Board of Veterans Appeal. This letter and enclosures contain very important information concerning your appeal. This is the first paragraph the veteran reads. Statement of the case. The letter clearly tells the veteran what to do with the statement of the case. We have enclosed the statement of the case of the summary of law and the evidence concerning your claim. This summary will help you make the best argument to the BVA on why you think our decision should be changed. End of paragraph. It does not say to look to the statement of the case to fix a defective notice error or to even consider when you file your appeal.
Mr. Franklin, what are you reading from?
The statement of the case.
Can you give me a record reference, please?
Yes, Your Honor.
Are you on the first page of the statement of the case?
The very first page,
okay.
Yes. But I'm on the cover letter.
On the cover letter of the statement of the case.
Sorry, no, okay. Cover letter. We refer to it as the notification letter in the brief, which in hindsight I wish I would have called it a cover letter.
Okay, all right. Got it.
It's also the same exact cover letter was submitted to the statement of the case that put this particular issue in front of the court, and that's at record 541. Either one of them, they say the exact same thing. 541.
One. Okay. Thank you.
Apologize. So after the cover letter tells the veteran what to do with the statement of the case, which the veteran's only supposed to look to the statement of the case to figure out how to make his best argument, it says what you need to do. Well, to complete your appeal, you know, you have to file a formal appeal. We've enclosed VA Form 9. Explain to us the benefit you want, the errors, and all that stuff. Now, in the third bold print, so you have your statement of case, what you need to do, it specifically says in bold when you need to do it. You must file your appeal with this office within 60 days from the date of this letter or within the remainder. Okay? This letter is undated. So the veteran's argument is this letter was defective when it left the VA. And the VA can only cure that defect by submitting new notice or allowing the veteran's appeal as timely, which it didn't do.
Why do you take that position? It can only be cured by submitting new notice.
Because the notice is defective.
The letter
is defective.
Okay, what about the statement of the case?
The statement of the case, first off, and more into answering your question, is that the statement of the case, for one thing, shouldn't contain a citation to Regulation 20.302. That's in violation of the VA's own regulation, 1930. That says information furnished with the statement of the case, with the statement of the case, the appellant and the representative will be furnished information on the right to file and the time limit for filing. Okay, 1930 was drafted before 20.302. So when the VA was sending out statement of the cases, it had this regulation 1930 that said, in addition to the statement of the case, we're going to send him notice on when his right is to file, okay? And then they draft regulation 20.302 that says, we'll presume the date of mailing the statement of the case is the statement of the case, not the cover letter. And why, I don't know. When the VA first crafted 20.302, it sent it out for notice and comment, it didn't have the presumption in it in the first draft. Somebody submitted a comment to the proposed regulation and said, define the date of mailing, and then the VA put in the date of mailing would be presumed to be the statement of the case, not the cover letter. Okay? In rating decisions at the VA, they always go by the notification letter or the cover letter to the rating decision. But for some reason, as a statement of the case, they arbitrarily picked the statement of the case. The statement of the case. Okay? And so, if I could direct the court's attention to the enabling statute, D1 says where the claimant is represented within the time specified in the chapter, files a notice of disagreement.
What statutory section are you reading from?
7105 D1, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Such agency shall prepare a statement of the case, and the statement of the case shall include the following: a summary of the evidence in the case pertinent to the issues or the issues with which the disagreement has been expressed, a citation to the pertinent laws and regulations, and a discussion of how such laws and regulations affect the agency's decision, and a decision on each issue and summary of the reasons for the decision. It doesn't tell them to include any information on when to file the appeal. And so the VA throwing that in there to the statement of the case is confusing, because the regulation is talking about when to file the appeal, when the statute says what you put in the statement of the case is the laws and the regulation and the reasons why the veteran lost his initial case. And the VA acknowledges that when they realize in 1930 that they're going to identify the deadline for the veteran to file his appeal by putting it in the notice or the cover letter. And so when the veteran gets a cover letter that says, use this, and then they don't date it, the VA can't put the blame on the veteran and say, you should have read page 15 of the statement of the case, and that should rectify the problem, because even if the veteran had done that in this case, it still doesn't make any sense. He gets the statement of the case that says, use this letter date. It's just assuming he went to page 15 of the statement of the case and said, well, this regulation says I have 60 days, that they presume it's 60 days from the date of mailing the statement of the case. But then he goes back to the cover letter and says, but this says to use this. That's confusing, okay?
Could I interrupt you there? So you're arguing that the notice in the cover letter was misleading because it didn't tell him to look at the date on the SOC, but the appellant has also testified that he didn't open the SOC and read it until August 9th, which would have been 68 days after the date on the SOC. So even if the cover letter had said, look at the date on the SOC, how could that have helped him? It would have just confirmed that he was already late.
Judge Meredith, you could only assume that if the VA told us when they mailed the statement of the case,
right? Well,
that's
a different question as to whether the presumption of when it was mailed has been rebutted.
You're asking me to assume that they did, in fact, mail it.
In your supplemental brief, you said it's misleading because it didn't instruct the appellant that he should substitute the SOC date as the date of mailing.
Right.
But the 68-day period had already expired at that point.
No, we don't know that. The appellant, the veteran,
that's a different question, but yes, I understand.
Believes he opened it in early August, okay? And if you look at my VVA transcript, he could have opened it on time. He admitted he doesn't know exactly when he received it. The judge questioned him and said, were you living at that address in June when presumably the VA mailed it? He was. He was back and forth between that address and a different address that he had in Longmont, Colorado.
Right.
But he doesn't know when he received it.
Well, he testified that it was around August 9th, and you cited that in your brief. But let me ask you a different way. So after opening this letter around August 9th, the appellant called your law firm. Within 2 days, the appellant had filed his substantive appeal. So what would he have done different if there was a date on this letter? I mean, I think you would put it as you filed immediately after hearing about this case. How did the letter impact when he filed?
Maybe he would have filed the Form 9 that was included with the statement of the case himself instead of wasting so much time trying to figure out when the VA mailed it.
2 days would have made a difference here?
It could have.
That would have been on day 68.
It could have. Also, when you have a defective notice, we don't look to what the veteran did or didn't do. The notice was defective no matter when it was sent.
Could he ever show, assuming the presumption is not rebutted, that June 2nd is the date of mailing. Could he ever show that he detrimentally relied on something when it happened after?
Yes, he waited 3 days to file, 3 days to file his appeal.
But you would still need June 2nd not to be the date of mailing.
If we make this assumption that the date he opened it is the date he received it. Also, I would ask you to look at the transcript of the other thing the veteran said. He read the letter and called the VA and asked the VA when they mailed it. The VA could not tell him when they mailed it. If you look at the transcript, the judge that was, the board member, I'm sorry, that was on this case was looking at his VBMS file when we were claiming non-receipt and problems with the cover letter. He told us that we had a decision there that we had not received and all these other various things. The judge said nothing about when the VA mailed it. The closest we have to the VA saying that they mailed this on the date they claim was when the Denver Regional Office Director, and this is at Record 50, I believe, responding on behalf of an inquirer I made to the Undersecretary, wrote a letter and said, hey, veteran, we admit we made a mistake. That cover letter should have been dated. But since the statement of the case was dated, it was sent to you on that date. They didn't say how it was sent. They're just relying on the regulation at that point, okay? So nobody in this whole process knows when that actual letter was mailed to the veteran.
Let us assume that the letter of notification was dated June 2nd, because I'm not quite sure what the answer is. Let me ask another way. Let's assume that that letter was dated June 2nd, and Mr. Krumlich opened it up, I think, around the 9th of August. Let's say he opened it up at the 9th of August.
Okay.
And then he went to see you, and you filed an SOC. Would that be considered late, or would that be considered on time? How would you, what is your response to that?
Well, under that assumption, yes, the VA would consider that late because the notification letter.
And you would be good with that?
I would accept that. Yeah, because the letter is clearly dated, and the statute says you have 60 days from the date of the mailing, and it's kind of common sense. And I believe the VA's practice before this regulation is we always go by the letter date, and then veterans have to prove non-receipt, you know, or they didn't get it when you would assume. That would be the judicial presumption, right, that they regularly discharge their duties, like the letter's dated June 2nd, so obviously or presumptively it went out on June 2nd. So in your scenario, I would accept that, but that's not what happened in this case.
About the regulatory presumption, in supplemental pleadings, both parties have now said that presumption can be rebutted, the regulatory presumption that the SOC was mailed on the date.
Yes, Judge Meredith, we both agree on that.
So do you read the board decision on appeal as having in any way addressed whether the presumption could have been rebutted in light of the undated letter, in light of the testimony that you provided about SOCs not always having the same date as the cover letters?
No, but whether the presumption can be rebutted or not rebutted is not anything that the judge really needed to consider. The 7105 allows a BVA judge to accept the appeal as timely even if it's filed late under certain circumstances. The secretary's argued that this regulation is somehow, you know, trumps the statute and everything else, and that the board and the regional office were just bound by this presumption that they couldn't accept this veteran's appeal. But they can. This court, I believe it's in Percy, the statute's it's a non-jurisdictional, the deadline's non-jurisdictional for one thing. And the RO may close a case if an appeal's not timely filed, but they certainly don't have to. So in this case, the undersecretary, the Denver Regional Office Director, and the DRO all could have said to accept this appeal as timely. When it got up to the judge, he doesn't need to discuss whether the presumption can be rebutted. I assume the judge knows the presumption can be rebutted. He looked at the facts of this case and chose not to accept the appeal as timely. And
even assume that the regulation should have been addressed, which it was in part by the board, and they did not address whether it could be rebutted, which both parties now say it can be.
Yes.
Is that something that we can address in the first instance, or would we need to remand for the board to address in the first instance whether it was rebutted here in light of your testimony, in light of the undated letter?
Yes, the veteran's seeking reversal, and I do not think this case needs to go back on remand for the judge.
So you think we can, in the first instance, say whether it was rebutted?
Yes, I would go a step further and would say that you should throw the regulation out. It completely conflicts with the statute, the enabling statute, 7105. You review constitutional issues de novo. When a regulation's in conflict with the statute, you review de novo. Like I said, the statute's clear on its face, so there's no deference to the VA. Even if there was, and we were going under the arbitrary and capricious standard, if you look at the history of the regulation, it makes no sense why they chose the statement of the case. They received one comment, and then it was statement of the case, and no explanation. They have rating decisions that go by notification letters, and they didn't use that in this situation. The only other situation that I found where they go by not the vessel that mails the document, but the document itself is a supplemental statement of the case. They use the date of the supplemental statement of the case to calculate a 30-day deadline. That's also wrong, not an issue in this case. But that one's not it's not detrimental to veterans because you don't have to respond to a supplemental statement of the case. So if they have a 30-day deadline and they don't make it, the case is still going to the board. However, in this case, this presumption that the VA has drafted to use as a shield, right, for their mistakes is now being used as a sword when nobody really, the VA admitted they made a mistake. They could accept this appeal as timely and correct their mistake, and instead, they never explained when the statement of the case is mailed. The judge didn't. The Denver Regional Office Director that has complete access to the VA systems, in their letter at Record 50, they could have simply said something like, oh, we're sorry we didn't mail the cover letter on time, but when I looked at the computer records, our process and our practice is that once the statement of the case is drafted, it instantly goes in the mail. It doesn't, as the evidence I submitted in this case shows that the statement of the case and the cover letter dates vary widely. Right, it's not always the date of the statement of the case and the cover letter. There's been, I believe I submitted 4 statements of the cases to the judge. I didn't put them in the record because I didn't want to confuse this particular veteran's record, but we were on a video conference. I showed the statement of the cases to the judge. In the transcript, you can see I explained one's 1 day different, one's 7 days different, I believe. One's 34 days different. If our veteran's was 34 days different, he would have been on time. We don't know when the VA mailed that. And I think Regulation 20.305 is invalid, and this court should actually invalidate that regulation. I hope you do so. But in this case, if you choose not to, the burden shifted to the VA. Once the veteran said there was an irregular process, the burden was on the VA to say, okay, but we know it went out on this date because of this. The VA had multiple opportunities to do that, and it completely failed. It never accepted its burden. The only thing it's done is point the finger at the veteran. They admitted they made a mistake, but then they point the finger at the veteran and said, you should have read page 15 of the statement of the case, like it was just glowing up through all those other pages, and he just, you know, should have filed his appeal on time. I'm out of time, Your Honors.
Mr. Franklin, we have more questions. I'm going to ask in 5 more minutes. I assume my colleagues may have a couple as well, but I have at least 2. One is kind of picks up on Judge Meredith's earlier questions regarding the 68 days and what would be a line of questioning leading to the ultimate question of harmless error, that, in fact, your client would have been late anyway given the scenario that played out, and isn't the lack of having a date on the letter really harmless error?
It can't be harmless error because it can never be harmless error. The notice was defective the minute it left the office, okay? Because when we're looking at due process violations, we don't look to the veteran to say, what did he or did he not do? It's just if there's a reasonable probability of a different outcome. And despite what this veteran did, other veterans can be receiving these, and maybe they didn't file the appeal late and try to get the VA to accept it on time. Maybe they read the statement of the case and the cover letter, and their cover letter was undated, and they went through and said, "Oh, wow, the VA has this presumption, even though I received it on this date, I go by the statement of the case date, and I'm late. And think about the VA. Even if the cover letter was 10 days different than the statement of the case, under the presumption, a veteran could file his appeal on time, and they could reject it because the statement of the case controls the date. Now, that's ridiculous. They would never do that in a pro-veteran system, right? But I didn't think they would send out an undated cover letter, and then the veteran simply walks in and says, you know, can you accept this appeal as timely? I didn't know. And it's like, well, let's really dig into what the veteran was thinking, okay? I don't know what he was thinking. Called the office, he was scared. He didn't know what the cover letter meant. He also had untreated PTSD at this time and a back that wasn't service-connected because the VA didn't have the service treatment records. He also didn't understand this whole time that he had his service treatment records, okay? Now, is that his fault? They kept saying they were denying his claim because they had no nexus or no evidence of an in-service injury. He didn't know what that meant either, but he was holding on to his STRs at his house. One day he shows up and says, is this what they're talking about? We submitted them, and his claim was granted. So veterans don't always understand the law, even though the VA charges them with knowledge of the law and knowledge of the regulations in a due process violation. That's never a defense. Knowledge of the law is not a defense in a due process violation.
Mr. Franklin, what should best practices, what should the VA have done?
What should the VA have done is simple. They should have just accepted the appeal as timely. The veteran already filed his Form 9, so there's no reason to submit new notice. He just submits his Form 9, explains what happened. They admit their mistake. They didn't have to admit their mistake. They would just accept the appeal as timely. It's even more egregious because they did admit that they made a mistake and then refused to accept his appeal as timely. That's simple. How could the VA fix the error now is also simple. This court has said that accurate notice is not a burden on the VA. Okay, so date the letter for one thing. The rest of the letter's fine. I would say take the regulation out of the statement of the case because the statement of the case is not the document you look to for the filing deadline anyways. Just keep it in the cover letter. And if you throw the regulation out or if you don't throw the regulation out, they should rewrite it and just say it's presumed that the date of mailing the cover letter is the date of mailing the statement of the case.
So I understand your request to us to be reversal as opposed to remand?
Yes, Your Honor. That's what I was trying to ask Judge Meredith is I don't want it to go on remand back to the judge to figure out if they could have rebutted the presumption because presumably they could say, yes, it could be rebutted, but we're just not accepting the appeal.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Callahan, if you need it, you will have additional 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'd like to begin today by framing the issue here. As appellant's argument fairly clearly indicates, the relevant question in this appeal is when the clock started running for appellant's timely substantive appeal. In answering that question, the Secretary believes that a crucial consideration is a careful distinction between the regulatory presumption created in 2302B and the presumption of regularity, as has been briefed in the appellant's pleadings. In answering this question and carefully distinguishing between these two presumptions, Secretary would admit that both presumptions have roles to play in this case. However, the determinative presumption and the determinative factor is the existence of the regulatory presumption created in 2302B. That presumption, again, just for the record, allows these parties to presume that the date of mailing of the statement of the case will be the same as the date of the statement of the case. That regulation answers the question relevant in this appeal.
So you're focusing on the more specific presumption in the regulation as opposed to the general presumption judicially created?
Yes, Your Honor. In addition to the fact that the regulatory presumption of 2302B is rather specifically tailored to this situation, which weighs in favor of preferring that presumption. The Secretary would also note that the presumption of regularity, as it appears to be constructed and conceived in appellant's arguments, is extremely narrow. The presumption of regularity often allows the parties to presume that a regular action of the Secretary has been followed, but should that presumption be rebutted, the burden shifts to the Secretary to demonstrate that the procedure was, in fact, followed. It's important to remember that in providing his argument, appellant has never argued that there was any problem with the actual mailing of the SOC or that he didn't receive the SOC. The only regular process he can direct the court to that wasn't arguably followed here is the provision of the date stamp on the notification letter attached to the SOC. That's an extremely narrow reading of the presumption of regularity, or I should say an application of the presumption of regularity, and it doesn't really provide us enough information to answer the relevant question here, because it's not clear from that construction what either party would be entitled to presume, or if the presumption of regularity were rebutted, what the Secretary would be required to prove. To the extent that the Secretary would be required to prove the date of mailing of the SOC, that is where the regulatory presumption of 2302B comes into play and provides the answer to that question.
Which is?
The SOC was mailed out June 2nd, 2015, making the substantive appeal due August 1st, 2015.
And I think Appellant's counsel just indicated that there's a variety of dates on different SOCs, and when those dates represent an accurate mailing or an inaccurate mailing. You're not suggesting that the presumption is not rebuttable, right?
No, certainly not.
Okay, so the question becomes, is the fact that there's a missing date on the letter, does that raise enough to rebut the presumption of regularity, right?
Well, again, Your Honor, I think
the regulation.
The construction used for the presumption of regularity is crucial to the extent that the regular procedure that we're talking about when considering the presumption of regularity is the provision of the date stamp. I don't think there's a lot of room to argue that that process was not followed. There is not a date stamp on the file copy of the letter, and appellant hasn't provided any argument that there was a date on his letter. Certainly his argument hinges on the fact that there wasn't. So to the extent that that's the construction of the presumption of regularity, certainly there is room to say that that presumption has been rebutted. However, I think, it's very important to keep the two presumptions distinct because they don't rely on one another and they don't always answer the same questions depending on how the presumption of regularity is framed and the regular process that's being talked about. To the extent that the question presented here is the date of mailing of the SOC, as I say, the presumption of regularity really doesn't provide us with anything to either presume or prove in that respect. To the extent that it would be found to require VA to show the date of mailing of the statement of the case, that is where the regulatory presumption of 2302B comes in.
The answer's on the SOC, you're saying?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. Right. If we look to page 15 of the SOC, Mr. Krumlich had all the information necessary to meaningfully participate in his appeal.
So he would have had to have opened the envelope, saw that there was no date on the letter, that is the notice letter. The statute that Mr. Franklin quoted didn't talk about a notice provision being in the SOC. And then you go through the SOC page by page and get to page 15, and finally it says 60 days. And that's reasonable.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that it is reasonable. As I say, appellant had all the information necessary to meaningfully participate in his appeal. As Mr. Franklin discussed, and I believe discussed with you, Chief Judge Davis, the appellant is presumed to know the laws for the benefits to which he's applying. That includes the regulatory presumption of 2302B. And the SOC itself is dated on all 18 pages of the document. So with those two facts alone, appellant had all the information necessary to understand the timely requirements for his substantive appeal. But
Mr. Callahan, that sounds like the argument that was made in Mayfield to me. Are you familiar with that case?
I am, Your Honor.
Right. And there, the argument was, taking three documents together, the appellant should have known what the notice required, the VCAA notice. The court didn't buy that. The Federal Circuit didn't buy that. But you're making a similar argument here because now we don't have three documents. We have one, but it's buried in 15 pages.
Well, Your Honor, I think the fact that we have one document is very important. In addition to the fact that it doesn't require so much cobbling as was required in Mayfield, I would point out that as a simply contextual and practical point, the notification letter that appellant discusses and the SOC itself are provided in a single mailing, and appellant hasn't provided any suggestion that that wasn't the case here. And so, being that they're provided in a single mailing, the Secretary would assert that a reasonable person, when trying to discern the date of the letter, would defer to the date that's on 18 of the 20 pages of that mailing. So to that extent, really, there isn't a lot of confusion. If you read the documents as entirely separate documents, say if they'd been mailed at separate times, then potentially there's more confusion there. But here, appellant had all the information he needed to meaningfully participate in this appeal.
Can I back us up a step? My claim stream that we're dealing with now on appeal the board found that the appellant was untimely in appealing a denial in 2013 of his claims for service connection for PTSD and a low back condition. In a different claim stream, the appellant has now been awarded service connection for both of those conditions, right?
Yes.
And he has a 2016 effective date?
Correct.
His initial claim was in 2011, so if he keeps this appeal stream alive, is it possible he could get benefits from his initial claim in 2011 to 2016 for those two conditions?
Your Honor, we believe that's the theory that would be pursued, yes.
And so VA is trying to keep this claim stream from being kept alive because of a letter, a form that at worst was 10 days late. But VA doesn't know it was 10 days late. You need us to rely on a presumption to say it was 10 days late. You haven't provided any evidence of when VA actually mailed this form, so you're potentially denying the veteran 5 years of back benefits on an assumption of when you may have mailed this, but you don't really know why. Does VA not have the authority to waive this 60-day period? Do you not have the ability to toll it, to grant him an extension? Why is this worth fighting?
Well, Your Honor, there are several mechanisms of the kind that you describe. Certainly the board retains and VA retains the ability to waive the substantive appeal requirement, as the court talked about in Percy. But again, there's nothing in Percy that suggests that that's required. It's a discretionary allowance.
So VA has the discretion to allow this appellant's appeal to be heard on the merits and is choosing not to.
Well, Your Honor, the Secretary would cast it slightly differently. The board is enforcing the regulations as they're charged to do, and the regulation says that the SOC was mailed June 2nd, 2015.
It says to presume that. Do you have any evidence? I know one of your manual provisions says that when you mail the SOC, you're supposed to go into the computer system and log in when it was sent. Have you looked into VACOLS, I think it is, to see what the date is in that system as to when his SOC was actually sent?
Your Honor, we have looked into what we have internally. Unfortunately, because this SOC was mailed 3 years ago and the manual is an ever-updating document, we don't have any information specifically to demonstrate when the letter was presumed. But I think that Your Honor's question, with respect, arguably shifts the burden to the Secretary. The presumption operates such that the Secretary and the Court is entitled to presume that the letter was mailed on June 2nd, 2015.
You're missing my point. It wasn't about what you can do with the presumption. It's why. Why is this worth fighting?
Well, Your Honor, I guess to use Your Honor's phrasing, it's worth fighting because that's the law. The regulation was duly passed. It has never been the subject of any.
But you just said you have discretion. VA does have discretion to allow this appeal to be heard on the merits.
Yes, Your Honor, we do retain the discretion to waive the substantive appeal requirement. But, again, this is a clear application of the regulatory presumption. This is an obvious application of the regulation. And so to the extent that Your Honor's question asks why does the VA simply not waive the requirement, again, I would point out that there's nothing to require VA to waive the requirement. And as
Other than good common sense, counsel, it seems to me that if you have the discretion, you've already granted a claim here on the same issues. So we're talking about really 5 years of back pay, aren't we?
Yes, Your Honor. Again,
so when you're talking with your supervisors and you all review cases to be brought to court, you have a responsibility to them to make a point or argue that, in fact, maybe this ought to be resolved differently instead of coming to this court.
Well, Your Honor, I think purely from an appellate standpoint, the decision-making is performed by the board. The board properly decided that the regulation was to be enforced. There's nothing incorrect about the board's decision, and there's no indication that they somehow failed in any of their duties. And so really what...
With the backlog of cases that you have, you mean to tell me that there is no room for deciding what to bring to this court and what not to bring because the board's decision is correct in your view?
Oh, certainly, Your Honor. I don't mean to suggest that there is no room for the Secretary's counsel to strategically bring things before the court or not. I simply mean to point out that so far as the Secretary sees the issue, there is no principled reason or means to return the case to the board because the board did correctly apply the regulation and the regulation is applicable. To the extent that the line of questioning from Your Honor and Judge Meredith gets at essentially the fairness of the situation and why the board did not simply waive the requirement under some sort of fairness, I think that the answer really does get back to Judge Meredith's question. Judge Meredith's question to appellant's counsel. There really is no reason here to find that appellant, you know, dutifully participated in his appeal. As I say, he had all the information necessary to know at least when the VA could require his substantive appeal to be due. And as Judge Meredith's questioning points out, his testimony before the board is that he didn't even open it until several days after the deadline would have arguably
passed.
You don't
have any evidence as to when it was mailed or received?
Certainly, Your Honor, no. We have no evidence about when it was received. We don't have any specific evidence about when it was mailed. But again, I think we need to be careful not to shift the burden over to the Secretary. The regulation has to be given effect here, absent some reason that it should not be. And I know the appellant has asked for the rate to be invalidated. It appears, my understanding of appellant's argument is that the regulation arguably should be invalidated under the Due Process Clause. He directs the court to Cushman versus Shinseki, which is a Federal Circuit case, where the circuit laid out that there are essentially two avenues by which to mount a due process challenge to a regulation. First, the procedural framework as it is generally applied in veterans' benefits claims may be challenged. Alternatively, the individual application of that procedural framework can be challenged on a fundamental fairness basis. It appears from appellant's briefing that he is mounting an as-applied challenge to the fundamental fairness of his adjudication. However, the Secretary would argue that because 2302B's regulatory presumption is operative in all cases and admittedly may be rebutted, but is still for consideration in all cases, and there's nothing unique about the application of the regulatory presumption in his case, appellant is really mounting a challenge to the procedural framework of the regulation as it is applied in all cases. And the Federal Circuit tells us in Cushman that the relevant authority to look to in such a challenge is the case of Walters versus the National Association of Radiation Survivors. That's a Supreme Court case in which the Supreme Court stated that the due process rules are shaped by the risk of error inherent in the process as it is applied to the generality of cases. That analysis, the Supreme Court explained, is dependent on the four-factor analysis of Matthews versus Eldridge, which takes into consideration the private interest at stake, the risk of erroneous deprivation of the right, the probable value of additional procedures, and the government's interests. But importantly, the Supreme Court stated in Radiation Survivors that in cases such as this one, where the government's interest is high, quote, it would take an extraordinarily strong showing of probability of error under the present system in order to warrant a holding that the procedure denies claimants due process of law.
Mr. Callahan, let me finish this one. You concede that the presumption has been rebutted.
The regulatory
presumption.
No, Your Honor, we
do not.
No, there's no evidence to suggest that the regulatory presumption has been rebutted. As we've discussed a little bit.
The letter is not sufficient, absent a date on it, is not sufficient to rebut the presumption of regularity there?
Correct, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. As we've discussed a little bit today, the parties are in agreement that clear evidence would be required to rebut the regulatory presumption. That would certainly be in existence if, as Judge Peach's question got to earlier, the letter did in fact bear a date stamp that was later than June 2nd, 2015. That would be clear evidence, as I believe Your Honor's question spoke to regarding the envelope. If the envelope bore a postmark that was after June 2nd, 2015, that would constitute clear evidence to rebut the presumption. But none of that's applicable here. This is squarely the situation contemplated by the regulation. Regulation is specifically contemplating a situation in which there is no alternative date presented, and the only date in the record is the date of the SOC itself. So the Secretary would not concede that the presumption has been rebutted, and because the presumption has not been rebutted, the regulation is to be given effect, absent some concerns, such as concerns regarding the constitutional validity. But in considering the constitutional validity under the Due Process Clause, if we look to the guidance provided in Radiation Survivors, the context of the regulation at least informs the analysis, because this regulation has been on the books since, or at least this portion of the regulation, excuse me, has been on the books since February of 1992. So that's almost 27 years. It's never been amended, at least this portion of the regulation, and it's also never been the subject of any precedential or non-precedential decision of this court. And while the Secretary understands that those facts don't definitively show that the regulatory presumption affords sufficient protection against error, such as the Supreme Court talked about in Radiation Survivors, those facts do provide a context that suggests that there is sufficient protection against error, and appellant really hasn't provided any evidence or even argument to say that the regulation doesn't provide sufficient protection against error in the generality of cases.
Counsel, let me ask you, let me go back. I mean, there's nowhere in any of VA's computers or records that would indicate that the SOC was mailed and the date or some indicator of when it was mailed in your VACALS or VOCALS system. Was the answer to Judge Meredith's question is no, there's nothing like that in the system?
Correct, Your Honor. The answer to Judge Meredith's question is no, we have no evidence to specifically demonstrate when the SOC was mailed. But again, I think we need to be very careful not to shift the burden of the presumption onto the Secretary.
And the second question is, to your knowledge, has the Board ever waived the 60 days?
To my knowledge, the case that springs to mind regarding waiver of the substantive appeal requirement is obviously Percy. That was a slightly different situation in which the Board did not waive the requirement, but this Court found that VA's actions had impliedly waived the requirement. Obviously, there were, I believe the number is around 80,000 decisions just last year, so I am not familiar with all of them. I am rather confident that at least in statistically in one of them, the Board did explicitly or impliedly waive the substantive appeal requirement, but I could not give you the specific facts of any particular
case.
And
how do you respond to the appellant's statements that he has documents that indicate that the date of the notification letter is different from the date of the statement of the case?
Well, Your Honor, as I understand appellant's argument, he is really presenting more of an experiential point that in his experience litigating veterans' benefits claims, there can be a variance between the date of the statement of the case and the date provided on the letter. And certainly the Secretary is not disputing that that occurs in any way. There's just no evidence in this case to clearly rebut the presumption created in 2302B. And so that is really the question that we need to be looking at.
Well, what kind of evidence would you think is satisfactory to the Board to rebut that presumption?
Well, certainly, Your Honor, I want to be careful not to adjudicate things for the Board, but as I say, if the letter did bear a date stamp that was after the date of the statement of the case, that would constitute clear evidence. If the envelope in which the documents were mailed was of record and that bore a later postmark, that would constitute clear evidence. But I think that, that clear evidence requires some kind of affirmative showing. That's not to say that the Board couldn't, in their judgment, find that there was clear evidence in situations other than that. But those are the obvious two examples that don't require me to speak for the Board too much.
You just suggested a date stamp that was after the SOC, if I heard you correctly.
Yes, Your Honor.
What if the date stamp were before the SOC?
That would be an admittedly confusing situation.
And so the absence of a date is not.
Your Honor. When I say that this situation would be confusing.
The date before would be confusing. The date after would be confusing. But the absence of a date is clear.
Well, no, Your Honor. When I say that the situation would be confusing, I mean more in the order of operations for which these procedures go through. Arguably, it would be rather confusing if the letter were mailed before the document attached to the letter were created, and to that extent it would be confusing. I don't think that there is confusion in a case like this. I also don't think that if the letter bore a date stamp later than the SOC, there would be really any confusion. I think there's a rather clear application of the regulatory presumption there to find that it had been rebutted, and as Appellant's argument appears to get to, 7105D and, in fact, 2302 would require that the appellant be afforded 60 days from that later date, the date of the notification letter. So I don't think there's any confusion in that situation. I don't think there's any confusion in this situation because we don't have any kind of confusing procedural process coming up, as your question kind of gets to.
Could talk a little bit about what is VA's internal practice when you're mailing a statement in the case? And your manual provisions, which talk about the transmittal letter that goes with the statement of the case, contains a note that says, important, the date on the SOC transmittal letter must be the date the SOC is sent to the appellant. So it is, and we can provide you with copies if you don't have a copy of that manual provision in front of you. Is it VA's normal practice to date the cover letter on the date it's sent?
It is, Your Honor. Yes. I would certainly point out, though, as I said earlier, that the manual is an ever-evolving document, and the notification letter we're talking about here is nearly 4 years old.
Right. The manual, the manual may be an ever-changing document, but your process, how do you can't be affording to change that every day. I mean,
certainly no, Your Honor. The processes do not change day to day. I simply pointed that out just to illuminate that there is some gray area here based on the fact that the SOC was created almost 4 years ago.
Your internal process appears to be you need to put the date on the letter because that's the date that it's sent on the letter. That wasn't done here. Your cover letter that's sent with the SOC says look at the date on the letter to determine when your 60-day period starts to run. Why would the cover letter say that if VA wants to presume the date on the SOC is the date that everyone should be looking for? And if your internal practice is to go based on the date of the letter, why does your regulation say look at the date on the SOC?
Well, Your Honor, as I said earlier, the regulatory presumption, is our position, is operative in all cases.
But should it not reflect your internal practice?
Well, I think that it does arguably reflect our internal
practice.
How?
If your manual provision says date the letter on the date it's sent, your cover letter says look at the date on the letter. Neither of those things suggests that VA considers the date on the SOC to be the operative date for when the 60-day period begins to run.
Well, the manual provision's instruction that the letters be dated on the date that they mail out is an attempt to be as veteran-friendly as possible and to administer the system as clearly as possible.
Is that what you're doing in this case?
Well, obviously the situation could have been clearer if the notification letter had been dated. But again, the regulation is operative in all cases, and the manual provision that you cite is really an attempt to be as clear as possible with the application of the regulation in cases where the letter is date-stamped. There's a very clear application of the regulatory presumption, as I say.
If that regulatory presumption does not accurately match up with what VA's internal practice is on mailing these SOCs and on what date you normally consider to start the 60-day period, is it not arbitrary to create a presumption that doesn't reflect your actual practice?
No, Your Honor, I don't think that it's arbitrary at all. Certainly, for as many instances as there are where the notification letter bears a date different from the SOC, in my personal experience, I have seen an equal number where the letter is dated the same day as the SOC. As I say, the Secretary's position is that providing the date stamp on the letter is really a means to be as overt as possible and to ensure as best as we can that appellant is provided the 60 days required by statute to provide his timely substantive appeal. So really, the question gets to the fact that the regulation does operate in all cases, and it really speaks to the Secretary's interest to orderly administer the benefits system, and that's what the regulation provides us. I don't agree that it's an arbitrary date so as to raise any kind of concern there. But again, I think that the entire discussion that we're having today really needs to be rooted in some discussion of how appellant would be granted the relief he requests. As I say, he's requesting that the regulation be invalidated. So far as I can understand appellant's pleadings, with absolute respect, it appears that the entire argument focuses around a due process concern. As I say, the context of the regulatory history really suggests that there isn't sufficient grounds on which to invalidate the regulation under a generally applicable argument to the procedural framework. To the extent that appellant presents an as-applied challenge to the individual adjudication of his claim, the Secretary would argue that that is not a challenge which really supports invalidation of the regulation so much as it supports vacature of the Board's decision in the particular case. But additionally, there really isn't sufficient grounds on which to find that there is reason to vacate the Board's decision on an as-applied challenge because Cushman tells us that the relevant test to look to in an as-applied challenge to the individual adjudication and the fundamental fairness of that adjudication is, and I'll paraphrase the Supreme Court here, whether the action in question has so infected the adjudication with unfairness as to make the resulting decision a denial of due process. That test comes from the case Romano versus Oklahoma, which the Federal Circuit cites in Cushman to support their findings. And here, as a lot of our discussion has gotten to today, Secretary's position...
Mr. Callahan, let me ask you to take a breath for a moment. You're on a roll.
I will try to slow down, Your Honor.
I'm going to slow you down. The problem that I have with the situation is the difficulty in
even if I accept your characterization of looking at this as applied to these particular circumstances in this particular case, if you are standing in the shoes of the veteran, would this notice be clear to you? And would the process of an undated letter give you the guidance that you need to file an appeal?
Well, Your Honor, in answering that question, I'm going to make the assumption that I opened the letter before the 60-day timeline from the date of the SOC had expired, which was not really the case in this appeal. But assuming that I had done that, I believe that the prudent actions of a claimant are rather clear, even if there could be some confusion regarding the date of the notification letter and the date of the SOC, and there could have been some tension there. A prudent applicant, I think a reasonably prudent applicant, would, as I say, defer to the date that appears on 18 of the 20 pages of the single mailing that he's provided when attempting to discern the date of the letter. And even if you were not willing to necessarily defer to that date, I believe that a reasonably prudent person would attempt to get their their timely substantive appeal filed by the 60-day timeline from the SOC, being that that's the only information presented in the statement of the case and the notification letter. So I think that a reasonably prudent action is rather clear from the, the notice provided to the appellant. As I say, he had a meaningful ability to participate in his appeal, and that is really the hallmark that is presented in much of the jurisprudence.
Could the department have done something differently here? Or maybe I should ask it differently. Best practices, I asked the appellate's counsel the same question. What could the RO have done when the RO learned of the absence of a date on the letter, on the notice letter? I'll stop there for the moment.
Well, Your Honor, I think that in the assumption that the notification letter has already been mailed out without a date on it, and the claimant has asserted that there was some confusion, I would argue that the RO followed the law in this case, and that is the best practice. While there are means, as Judge Meredith's questions get to, by which the substantive appeal could have been accepted or even the requirement waived, I believe that the RO did follow the regulation and therefore the law. And so depending on one's definition of best practices, I would argue that following the law is a best practice, generally. As I was saying, Your Honor, regarding the as-applied challenge, I don't believe that that mechanism really supports invalidation of the regulation.
Doesn't counsel ask for reversal of the board decision?
Yes, he did ask for reversal of the board's decision. Again, I think that it's a little difficult to square that with any particular application of an avenue of law, to the extent that appellant is asking for invalidation and of the regulation and therefore reversal on those grounds, it's not supported. I see that my time is running up. I'm not sure if that involves the 5 minutes.
You may have extra time. We may have more questions.
Okay.
It's 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Sure.
As I was saying, though, there really isn't grounds to invalidate the regulation on an as-applied basis to the extent that appellant's asking for reversal under something like the situation presented in Percy, which I know he referenced during his argument. This is really not an analogous case to Percy in any way. While Percy stands for the proposition, as I say, that the board retains the ability to waive the substantive appeal requirement, the precedent set in Percy is very different because in that case, the claimant provided the substantive appeal late, but the VA or the RO continued to adjudicate the claim as if the filing had been timely, and it wasn't until the case got to the board that the board noted the untimeliness and dismissed the case. That is not the case here. As I say, the SOC was at least arguably mailed on June 2nd, 2015. His Form 9 substantive appeal was submitted August 11th, so that would have been 10 days late. And then only 14 days after that, he was notified by the RO that this was an untimely filing. So this really isn't an analogous case to the situation in Percy. And I think that it's important to bear that in mind. While the VA retains the discretion to waive the requirement, it's not required to waive the requirement in any way. And certainly a clear application of the regulation doesn't illuminate that there would have been any failing in the board's statement of reasons and basis, so it's to support remand. But again, I think it's important to remember that appellant isn't asking for remand in this case.
Counsel, could you tell me again, where did this presumption of contained in the regulation come from? What is the rationale, and what good does it serve?
Certainly, Your Honor. The Secretary's interest in an orderly administration of the veterans' benefits system is the primary interest that is served by this regulatory presumption. The regulation, or I should say the regulatory presumption, at least arguably in some descriptions, as appellant points out in his supplement, has been around for quite some time. The regulatory presumption as it currently appears was first proposed in August of 1989 in response to the Veterans Judicial Review Act, as the regulations were kind of wholesale amended in order to allow for an orderly application of the system in furtherance of your jurisdiction.
But why choose the statement of the case as the date? Why not say something like 5 days after or something? I mean, I don't understand why you chose the statement of the case date as the presumption, as the presumed date of mailing, that it wasn't some other date.
Well, Your Honor, because the date of the statement of the case is a date that we have actual knowledge of. We know when the statement of the case was created, at least in cases like this where the statement of the case bears a date. And to, I guess, carry off of Chief Judge Davis's question, best practices would obviously be for the statement of the case to be mailed out on the day it was created so as to prevent any kind of confusion regarding the 60-day timeline. So it is a date that we have actual knowledge of. If we were to say 10 days or something from the date of the statement of the case, that is a rather arbitrary selection of how many days from the date on which we have actual knowledge. So that is how the date is selected, or I guess the rationale behind the selection of that date, and the provision and the regulatory presumption allow us to orderly administer the veterans' benefits system. As I say, the regulation or this presumption has been on the books for quite some time, at least in some form. The presumption, as it currently appears, has been on the books for almost 27 years and has never been amended or ever been the subject of any discussion from this court in any, or I should say, should never been the subject of any decision from this court.
Mr. Callahan,
yes.
What would you describe as the critical purpose of the statement of the case?
I think that the critical purpose of the statement of the case, if we look to 7105, is rather clear. It's to provide the information necessary for the appellants the claimants to meaningfully participate in their appeal. As I say, appellant had that information here. I think the reasonably prudent appellant had all the information necessary to at least know when their substantive appeal could be considered to be due.
Would you say that the critical purpose is of that document is to know when the appeal period runs?
Well, yes, Your Honor. As I say, it's to provide all the necessary information.
Let's look at the statute, Mr. Callahan. You can generalize that nicely, but there are some specifics in the statute that Mr. Franklin pointed out. There's nowhere in that statute that talks about notice to the appellant regarding appeal dates, is there?
Not with regard to appeal dates specifically,
right.
Your Honor.
So the answer is no.
I do see my time has run out.
Now, you're getting more time.
Okay.
Five more minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Nowhere in that statute does it say on section 7105 D1, if you go through the list, a statement of the case shall include the following. I'll admit it doesn't say it's prohibited either, but it says it shall include, at least it shall include the following. Talks about a summary of the evidence in the case pertinent to the issue or issues with which disagreement has been expressed, a citation to pertinent laws and regulations, and a discussion of how such laws and regulations affect the agency's decision, and C, the decision on each issue, and a summary of the reasons for such decision. That, it seems to me, to be a very critical purpose of the SOC. And if you were missing any of those elements, I suggest that the SOC may be defective. Wouldn't you agree?
Certainly, Your Honor, if any of the elements that were outlined in the statute were
right.
Not present in the SOC, okay. Then yes.
Okay, so the SOC now contains, buried on page 15,
a date for appeal. And the SOC is not purporting by statute to be an appellate rights statute, is it?
Certainly, Your Honor. I think to the extent that I understand the question, no, the SOC isn't necessarily a statement of appellate rights. It is a statement providing the appellant the information necessary to engage with their case.
On a substantive basis, which you may argue may include a date, an appellate date, but that doesn't seem to me to be the primary purpose of the statement of the case. And so why bury it in the SOC as a fallback or a fail-safe provision for the VA? Wouldn't it be better for the veteran, for this non-adversarial veteran's system, to have a very clear notice to the veteran of when to appeal and what the date is, as opposed to expecting the veteran to dig through 15 pages of material that's maybe not relevant to the veteran to find out, oh, well, the date that's on the bottom of every page is the date I should pay attention to?
Well, Your Honor, I think that in answering that question, with respect, we have to be careful not to go down the slippery slope of presuming that the veterans aren't reading all of the information provided to them. There is, as you say, a generally veteran-friendly culture, and certainly case law regarding sufficiency of the notice provided to claimants, as they pursue their claims suggests that we are tasked with providing them all the information that is required. And so the line of thought that because this appeared somehow on page 15 instead of page 1 of the SOC is pertinent, I think, goes down a slippery slope of saying that the claimants are not reading all of the information provided to them. And I think that is a very tricky thing to presume, particularly given, as appellant's counsel pointed out, I think it's page 718 of the record, the notification letter, as all notification letters say, states that it is the document contains relevant information. I don't have the specific quote. Let's see here. Page 718 of the record, it says that the SOC is a summary to help you make the best arguments to the BVA on why you think our decision should be changed. It also says that the letter contains, quote, very important information concerning your appeal. And so right off the top, on page 1, appellant was told that the document contains very important information for his appeal. So I think that in addition to the fact that it's a somewhat slippery slope to presume that they're not reading.
Well, who's presuming they're not reading? Where'd that come from?
Well, I think that your question, Your Honor,
you think my question suggested a presumption that the veteran's not reading when I say it's buried on page 15?
Well, I think that the line of thought that because the statement appears on page 15 of the SOC is somehow relevant, as opposed to if the information appeared
on page 1.
One,
I think as a veteran it might be a little bit more clear to the veteran that, hey, this is important. What about if it's on page 30? Are you kidding me?
Oh, again,
I don't think there's a presumption there at all, counsel.
Well, I think that the question presumes that potentially the claimants would not read all the way through.
I think that's a misinterpretation of the question.
I apologize, Your Honor, if I'm misunderstanding the question.
There's no presumption there whatsoever other than to say, factually, that the provision is buried on page 15.
True, Your Honor, but the fact that it's on page 15 doesn't suggest any kind of importance of the information. And as I say,
really?
The letter, I would argue
so
no.
So that information is just as important as any information that would be on page 1. Or even if it were on a separate page. 5 more minutes, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, I would say that the information contained in the document is not arranged in order of importance. It is a careful statement of all the information necessary for a claimant to meaningfully participate in their appeal, but there's no suggestion that the information is somehow arranged in order of importance.
Yeah.
And so the fact that it appears on page 15 of the SOC really, I do not think, is suggestive of any kind of unfairness. But again, in discussing this case, I think we have to be careful to make sure to round back to some provision of law that would allow for the operation of the relief that appellant seeks here. And as I say, I really do not see a grounds on which to apply the due process clause here, because either under a general challenge to the procedural framework, there's no even argument that the regulation provides an insufficient protection against error. And under an as-applied challenge, as I believe appellant is presenting, there really isn't a showing of sufficient unfairness to rise to the level that it has so infected the proceedings with unfairness as to render it a violation of due process, particularly when we look at the analysis presented by the Federal Circuit in Cushman and the Supreme Court in Romano, the context becomes very important if, in those cases. And I don't think that the arguable unfairness in this case rises to nearly the level presented in those cases, particularly concerning that the case in Romano involved a death penalty charge. I think that this is, as I, my answer to Chief Judge Davis's question got to earlier, really a case where appellant had all the information necessary for a reasonably prudent person to meaningfully participate in their appeal, or at least to know when their substantive appeal could be considered due. In light of the fact that there's really not a grounds on which to invalidate the regulation or vacate the board's decision on due process grounds, the regulation is to be given effect, as the Federal Circuit laid out in Glover versus West when it stated that duly passed and unambiguous regulations are to be given effect by the courts, absence of extraordinary circumstance, such as due process concerns. But if the regulation is to be given effect, then the board's decision should be affirmed because it clearly applied the regulatory presumption. So with that, Your Honors, if there are no further questions, I would like to simply ask that the board's decision be affirmed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If the recitation to the 20.302 in the statement of the case is so important for the veteran, why is it not highlighted or in bold, and why doesn't it appear on a page other than page 15? If you look to the cover letter, there's only three things that the VA points out to the veteran. Statement of the case is in bold. It says, this is what you use to decide how to make your appeal. What you need to do, use the Form 9, because that's the document we use to initiate your appeal. And when you need to do it, clearly in bold, follow the letter date. Now, the Secretary's only defense to the appellant's claim is the presumption in the regulation. And this Court has said in Piano v. Brown, I believe, that the VA can't keep saying that they have this presumption to prove that the case wasn't shifted. So I'm arguing that the burden shifted to the VA to prove that they mailed it on time, and all they've said is that they have a presumption in this regulation. That's not good enough to meet their burden to show that the statement of the case was mailed when they say it was. Noah v. McDonald, misleading notice is a due process violation that can only be fixed with new notice. Or accepting the case doesn't say it, but we would argue that just simply accepting the client's appeal as timely would fix that. Chief Judge Davis, you brought up Mayfield. In Mayfield, this court said, VA can cure insufficient notice with new notice, and that case involved 5103 notice after initial decision, but the court was pretty clear that when they send out a defective notice that interferes with the veteran's right, which would be this veteran's right to his earlier effective day for his 5 years of benefit, as you pointed out, Judge Meredith, that they should send out new notice or accept the appeals timely. The VA's process does change every day. There is no regular process in when the VA mails things and when they do things. It's changing every day. Question number one in your order for supplemental briefing talked about, in light of the Ashley v. Derwinski case, what types of evidence can be used to rebut a presumption. That's a very important question that this court should address as well, and the answer to that is any evidence. The veteran should always be allowed to bring any evidence into this proceeding to prove that something the VA says happened didn't happen, and that's because of the VA's process changing on a daily basis. Chief Judge Davis, I believe you were on the Crane case, if you weren't, I'm mistaken, but in Crane, the veteran was saying he didn't receive some sort of decision. I don't remember if it was the rating decision or the SOC. And at that time, the court noted that the veteran had to make an assertion of non-receipt and then come in with some sort of proof that the VA received it back as non-deliverable which is an impossible standard for a veteran to meet. Obviously, if the VA didn't receive it back as non-deliverable, it could have went to the wrong address, and the person there could have simply threw it in the trash. It would have never came back to the VA or a litany of reasons. But the important thing in the Crane case is I think this court recognized that the veteran having to prove the VA's non-receipt was too high of a standard. They can't do that. And in that case, they found out that there was a decent address in the file, and the VA had actually used the wrong address. But the evidentiary standard was going down. And the evidence can be on a case-by-case basis. The VA and the court should never allow a veteran not to bring in evidence. The federal rules of evidence simply don't apply to this case. And the VA's regular procedures, changing on a day-to-day basis, is in the Crane case. But the dates where the courts required or the veterans used a postmark to show he didn't receive it when the VA says they received it, the VA doesn't always use postmarks anymore. Things are coming not from the regional offices anymore. They come from a centralized mailing intake. We receive letters that the gum that's not licked or whoever was in charge of sealing the envelope, it's not sealed. We get a one blank page with maybe my address on it and a barcode, but no enclosures. So we don't even know what veteran's case that goes to. So that's not in this record. But don't limit the veteran's ability to prove that the VA didn't do something he's claiming he did. On a case-by-case basis, you can choose to accept that. In this case, the board could have looked at those SOCs and having the power to accept it as timely, could have said, yeah, that's a rational, reasonable thing to do that judge chose not to. But don't put a limit on what we can, as practitioners, don't take tools out of our toolbox to help the veterans. And this presumption that the VA is using, the burden shifted. They didn't meet their burden, and this veteran should win.
What made the burden shift, counsel?
The burden shifted when the VA admitted on Record 50 that they made a mistake by not dating the cover letter. That implies that the cover letter should have been dated, so something's wrong in the regular process. The other SOC that put this claimant issue, it's dated as well. So that looks unregular. The veteran pointed out that every other single letter he received in his file was not dated. So if you just look to this record, the fact that the letter is undated and the director from the Denver office said, yes, that was a mistake on our part. We apologize for this inconvenience. However, the statement of the case is dated. Okay, so something's irregular there. Like I was explaining earlier, the VA could have explained why that statement of the case went out when they say it did. I wanted to point out aside from just the burden, the presumption that the VA mailed it on the date of the SOC, when there's a possible due process violation, whether I argued that well enough or accurate enough in my opening brief doesn't mean there's not a due process violation. This court can review any constitutional violation de novo, whether I argue it or not. And I would direct the secretary to review this court's rules. I don't know the particular rule number, but it says contents of the secretary's brief. If I should happen to not plead the due process violation right, or the secretary actually, or the, excuse me, the board member misapplied the law, the secretary is actually under a duty under this court's rules to point the error out to the court and suggest a remedy. So we're here now arguing due process. If anything that I didn't do or the veteran didn't do is inadequate enough, that doesn't mean he loses the case. Again, we would ask for reversal of the board's decision. There's no reason to send it back to the judge to discuss what he did or didn't do. Reversal is the appropriate remedy when the board member simply made a mistake in law. And if the court disagrees, then the claim should be, the appeal should be accepted as timely, and the veteran should be just allowed to move on now.
Earlier in your argument, you made a statement about the remedy of the case, which would be to, quote, throw out the regulation. Now, is the entire regulation 20.302 or just the presumption?
So it would actually be in the regulation, it's, I hate to say this, regulation is confusing until you understand it, and it's not so confusing. If you look towards the end, so B, the last sentence says, the date of mailing of the statement of the case will be presumed to be the same as the date of the statement of the case. That's the part that's not valid. That's the part that should be thrown out. The rest of the regulations basically in line with the statute. If you continue on, it says, and the date of mailing the letter of notification of the termination will be presumed to be the same date as a letter for purpose of determining whether an appeal is filed. So this regulation is a little confusing. I believe the secretary in his brief and me at the and myself at the board hearing in the transcript sort of assumed that when they talk about letter of notification, they're actually talking about what we're arguing here, the cover letter. So it's like...
To the SOC.
To the SOC, but that's not what that regulation is referring to, because if you look up at 2302A, the only reason the board's throwing in a notice letter right there is because veterans have two appeal periods to an SOC, right? They have the 60 days from the date the statement of the case is mailed, but they also have 1 year from the date of the original determination. And so they kind of just throw those two things together, and because they have those two appeal periods, they're saying, well, the date of mailing the statement of the case is going to be the statement of the case, not the cover letter. But if you're within that 1 year appeal period of the original regional office decision, then we'll presume that the date that notification letter was mailed was the date of the notification letter. And so why can't it simply be that for the statement of the case? Why can't the notification letter that accompanies the statement of the case be the presumption? So, sorry, Judge Peach, but to answer your question, no, I'm only saying the date of mailing the statement of the case will be presumed to be the same as the date of the statement of the case. That should be invalidated.
Anything else? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
The case will be considered submitted for consideration. The court will now come down and greet counsel.
All rise.